Perfect.
So I will briefly recapitulate what we did last time, and then proceed with some concrete examples of real space renormalization, and then towards the end, complete the two-dimensional Ising model solution using the transfer matrix method. So the last, I think in the last class that I started this idea of renormalization, it turns out to be a very powerful way of thinking about problems in physics, particularly when there are many length scales. And renormalization procedure is actually part of physics, because we don't realize it, because we don't write down a recursion relation and then think recursively. For example, in any problem you take, we say that many degrees of freedom are not relevant, they are irrelevant. So focus on relevant degrees of freedom. Like if you study hydrogen atom, what's going on inside the proton is not important at our energy scale. Similarly, when you study lattice dynamics of a metal, so
yes? We'll see you after the lecture.
You are welcome to sit here. Sorry, no, I didn't mean it. Yeah, please go around and.
No, go ahead. We sit for a while.
I was mentioning that the process of renormalization, or identifying suitable degree of freedom at relevant energy scales and length scale, is very common in physics. Like when you study lattice dynamics of a metal, you have two degrees of freedom that you have to consider, namely electrons, which can be very easily excited because you have a Fermi surface. Then you have lattice vibration. Or when you consider the vibrational study of a molecule, there are electrons which are running around, forming covalent bonds and so on. But when you focus on nuclear degree of freedom, what you say is that you say that you can integrate over electron degree of freedom, or you can do what is called Born-Oppenheimer approximation. So you effectively forget about electron degree of freedom and take its effect through so-called force constant and screening and so on in the case of metal. So renormalization is something that we do routinely in physics without saying so. But in the case of critical phenomena, we are forced to do it in a very systematic fashion and to learn about the hierarchy that is hidden in this very remarkable critical phenomena. And also, right at the first lecture, I pointed out about the issue of emergence. And it turns out renormalization group allows you to understand emergence in a variety of situations, not only in physics, even in outside, in a very systematic way. We pointed out that even thermodynamics of liquid gas system gave you a critical point, a critical situation in liquid and gas, which has no, you don't derive it from Newton's laws or you don't derive it from any first principles. It's an emergent property of large number of degree of freedom. Now, so that was one good example. It gave you a new emergent property in thermodynamic system. But then now, after renormalization group development, we understand there are hierarchy of things there, are different universality classes. For example, we said that critical phenomena can be characterized by these six exponents, mostly in thermodynamic system. Specific heat exponent, magnetization exponent, and susceptibility, and so on. And then for liquid gas, it took some values, then people found that if you take a Heisenberg ferromagnet or a ferroelectric, it starts having different value. That's where the idea of universality class, which classified things according to the dimension of the system that we are considering. Like two-dimensional Ising model, when you solve it, you get some exponents. When you solve three-dimensional Ising model, you get some other exponents. When you look at three-dimensional Heisenberg, you get different exponents. So things are classified according to dimensionality and number of components of the order parameter and so on. So RG helps you to find these things, the critical behavior, in a very beautiful and nice way. Okay. So this is basically what I was mentioning yesterday in the last class, that renormalization group is a powerful and systematic program to understand systems which are approaching a critical state, where things are happening at different scale. And they are often parameterized by few parameters. And we also pointed out that all these things are not independent. There are so-called scaling laws which connect these exponents. And eventually, for the case of magnets, you are left with only two numbers, something called thermal exponent and the magnetization exponent. So this also follows from the scaling hypothesis, which can be rationalized using this renormalization group idea. So it's a very, very powerful idea. As I pointed out briefly yesterday, it's going to, in other fields, like people doing turbulence use renormalization group idea. And as I said, people doing neural network and deep learning, there apparently there is this renormalization group ideas there in a very deep way. Okay. Now I go back to the general thing that I said, that in a very general way, you say that you have a classical Hamiltonian which has several parameters, J, J1. So what you would like to do is, you'd like to see the physics of this Hamiltonian or physics of the system at different length scales. So often you are given microscopic degree of freedom. So you have spin variable, which can take two values. And then you have some exchange constant, which tells that spins have to be parallel. That's energetically favorable. Then you have Avogadro number of large number of systems. And the traditional method is to study this, like Ansager did, solve it exactly in two dimensions or solve it approximately. The renormalization group, what you do is you step back and say that we are reaching a critical system. I would like to see how this Hamiltonian looks like in terms of new degree of freedom that emerge. Because after all, in a ferromagnet, two neighbors are very strongly correlated. So they are kind of some form collective variable. How these collective variables start emerging? We know the nature of the collective variable depending on the system. And how it modifies the coupling among those new collective variables. So renormalization group is a program in which you start with J, J1, J2, and so on, and then look at it in the next length scale. I explicitly did it for one-dimensional Ising model. We will do it in two-dimensional Ising model. How it gets modified, and then in the third step, and so on. So it's a way of systematically looking at how the degrees of freedom behave as you go to longer and longer length scale. And this kind of way of thinking about it, which Kadanoff started, as I mentioned last time, gave Wilson the idea that you have to think about this renormalization group as a flow in parameter space. And then that general flow immediately tells you there are notions of fixed point. And there can be fixed points which attracts or which ripples, or there are notions of limit cycles and a variety of things that we know in dynamical systems immediately becomes very useful to understand this. And also another next thing is, as you learn the system slowly at different length scale, you essentially get important information that you want. You don't need to evaluate the partition function completely. That is, you focus on critical phenomena, so you essentially find the least, you know, way with least effort to get at these quantities. And this is what renormalization group does. You don't need to solve the problem completely. But on the way, it teaches you many, many things, which is what, okay. Now, as I said, the standard Hamiltonian that we are given contains one parameter or two. For example, if there can be an external magnetic field. So when you do renormalization, as I explicitly showed in the case of two dimension, this step, when you go from here to here, you will get new coupling constants. Then there will be proliferation. So here I have, to take care of that, I have formally started with a general set of many coupling constants, which keeps going. So if I am able to get free energy and do renormalization, starting with this general coupling constant, the functional form of my free energy is not going to change. This is something I pointed out, that suppose F is the free energy. Now this J will stand for many coupling constants. So I put it in a curly bracket, plus some scale factor. Because I'm dealing with a d-dimensional system, the new free energy will be in terms of new degree of freedom. And since so many lattice sites or so many degree of freedom are coupled together, there is a scaling of the energy. And then you will get. So this is a very formal statement. It is not solution of the problem. We just say that you start with some general Hamiltonian within the universality class. That is, I'm talking about Ising model, I'm talking about nearest neighbor coupling, and so on. And then I formally evaluate the free energy, and then do what I described as decimation. I will recollect it for you. And then you say that the old free energy is connected to the new free energy, same functional form, but with some modified coupling constant. And each time you do this renormalization operation, you will be spilling out a constant term. For example, you can do the same thing here. That is, you can go from here to here. And then that will give another constant term. Now, it's interesting. The constant term that accumulates gives you the full regular free energy. And what is left here gives you the singular part of the free energy. OK. Now, we also said that so what I'm doing is I'm doing a recurrence. That is, I start with some J. The next, let me say, in general, the n plus 1 step will be equal to some. So there is some nonlinear function which takes you the set of coupling constants that you give me and then generates the next level. Now, if you can get an approximate form of this function R, the problem is solved. To the extent that you have made approximations, you will get accurate results or very bad results. So most of the game in renormalization group analysis is to find out the optimal form of R, and then the optimal parameter space. That is, you don't want to start with 10 parameter space. Ideally, you'd like to have just one parameter and see the flow in that direction. And we will see, if you keep that in mind, already you can get very nice approximate results for two-dimensional Ising model, which is accurate within 30%, for example. Then you can sharpen it. Now these days, you can go up to 1%. So it's a remarkable thing that which gives you nature of singularities in thermodynamic systems very nicely. I should also point out before I, as a general statement, that apart from statistical mechanical systems, which are critical, many of the quantum many-body theory that people are studying in the condensed matter context, and many field theories people are struggling with, all our string theory friends and quantum gravity people, some of them are so-called scale invariant theories. That is, these are all theories in which you don't have a length scale. So then hiding in those theories are these kind of exponents. They are, in the context of conformal field theory, they are called central charges and various dimensions of operators. So even there, even though you deal with quantum probabilities, not classical probability the way we are doing, but the mathematics behind seems to be very similar. That's why there is a very strong connection between statistical mechanics and the conformal field theories and quantum field theory. So if you learn statistical mechanics, you'll learn many of these things. It'll really help you to understand and suggest new methods. So there's a lot of interplay between both fields. And as I said, this general method goes beyond physics. OK. So let us look at this flow formally. I said that when you give this kind of nonlinear recursion relation, it looks like a dynamical system. You know, I'm sure you have come across mapping, discrete maps. That is, you give me a function, a number x of n, I will give you another function xn plus 1. There is a famous dynamical map. Maybe with put some restrictions on these x's, and then you give me a number, I will give you the next number and keep doing it. And remarkable things happen as a function of lambda. That is, at the first instant, you reach a fixed point and change the lambda. For a range of lambda, you get two fixed points. And then change it further, you get four. So periodic doubling. Every time the period gets doubled, and you get a rich variety of things. Even from this very simple, something called logistic map, I think, there are many, many maps. And even in people trying to understand whether, you know, the famous Lorentz model, which abstract complicated weather problem into three nonlinear variables, and you get, that's where this butterfly effect and chaos and all these things came about. So formally, this is all contained in here. So we can use all this knowledge in understanding here. So the first, yeah.
Is it possible for the R, the function R, to depend on J, n minus 1?
Yes, exactly. Because how did I land at Jn from Jn minus 1? So it depends on where I started. N equal to 1 is the initial point. Then I take, OK, that will become clear when I do this. So let me go to the parameter space. Let's say J1, J2. This is formal. And then because I will do some simple formal analysis and do an analysis close to the fixed point. Then we'll see how everything. So the structure, so there is a fixed point here, let's say in the parameter space. Then it turns out when you do these things, the following thing happens. There is a surface, which we will see what it is. It's called critical surface. That surface, you start from any point on the two-dimensional surface, you flow to this point. So for example, if you take Ansager's Ising model in two dimension, there is a value of J as given by Ansager at which the system is critical. But if you start at that, that will correspond to, let's say, some point here, that there is only one coupling constant. Then as you do renormalization, it will keep moving in parameter space and then reach a critical point in which all the lattice details and everything will be irrelevant if you sit at the critical point. So this is a very important notion. Please think about it, because even though we have solved Ansager Ising model for the critical behavior, that is, we have got the exact analytic expression, it doesn't mean that we know this full information about renormalization. So Ansager's solution corresponds to one particular point. And since that point is a critical point, that means if you do renormalization, it will flow to some universal point. In fact, we do not know what it is. We know approximately by playing with this. So everything will be attracted to this. This is called a critical surface. Now you may wonder, so I started from here, and then let's say I move here. Then if I started with nearest neighbor coupling, I'll generate next nearest neighbor coupling, and so on. Then somehow they are getting renormalized when you reach a fixed point. So quickly we will see the notion that there are some variables which are irrelevant as far as this fixed point is concerned. So they can be renormalized away, and then what all you need to know is about the situation near this particular point. So the notion of irrelevance comes here. Suppose you move along some line like this. This will be, in fact, an unstable fixed point. That is, you start very close to it, then you will flow away. So critical surface is the one in which every point under renormalization is attracted to the critical point. And you can imagine the richness of this parameter space. There could be a critical point related to tricritical point, tetracritical point. Formally, many of these things are contained in this particular space. But typically, we focus on identify some one fixed point, a critical point, approximately, and do the analysis. Okay, so let me do quickly repeat what I did for one-dimensionalizing model, and then move forward from there. So one-dimensionalizing model is very easily solvable. So when you So using three normalization, we can solve exactly the one-dimensionalizing model. So we will see in some detail how the critical surface and various things look like. So it is e to the power of, so I will use this notation, j means j by kt. So please forgive me, I have been using different notation earlier. But basically, this is the idea. So I want to take the trace, which is summing over all spins. This is what I'm interested in. So what I do is basically I focus on spins defined on odd side and then integrate them over. Because that amounts to, as I pointed before, somehow constructing a collective variable and then looking at the Hamiltonian in terms of this new collective variable. And here it can be done very easily because a spin I is connected to the left side and plus one. And then I can, now what I do is I take the trace over this spin. So this can be done in two ways. Let's first do it in the way that we did before. You expand this first e to the power of beta, j, then you get 1 plus sign it. OK, now when you sum over Si equal to plus or minus 1, you find that it trivially many terms trivially vanish, leaving you with so you can pull this out and write it as and you immediately notice the similarity of this term to the old term because the old term looked like between two neighbors. So if I pulled out cos j, I have 1 plus si plus 1. So the form remains invariant. That is, I have some constant term. I'll come to it. Otherwise, I had tan hyperbolic to begin with between neighboring spin. Now having eliminated alternate spins, the new neighbors have a connection which is tan hyperbolic squared j. So that means I have a connection that is tan hyperbolic j prime is equal to so the renormalization takes me to a new value j which is given by this recursion relation. So this is the recursion relation that I was writing before. Now it's straightforward to do the same thing in the presence of magnetic field. Magnetic field also keeps the form the same, as you can very quickly see, because what it does is it adds a term h Then when you do this, you'll get, again, cosh, sine, hyperbolic, and so on. But at the end of the day, you have a very simple equation, which I request you to do it because it's fairly straightforward. It's somewhat lengthy, but you know it's good to. So this recursion relation in terms of this new variable, now I'm going to define variable x is equal to e to the power of minus 4k, 4j, then y is equal to e to the power of minus 2h. So this is a magnetic field term, and this. So then it becomes more complicated than this, but it can be written down. So you have x prime is equal to x into then similarly the equation for see we are used to solving 1D Ising model in one step and getting the final free energy, but here we seem to be going through a tortuous route because we are changing the scale and getting some, but it's going to give us insight about what is actually going on and how things are organizing and how to get some general principle out of this very simple model. Okay, so now my parameter space now has two parameters, namely j and h are the corresponding x and y. So now I flow in these two dimensions. So I would like to know how the flow diagram looks like in these two dimensions. It turns out this flow diagram is well represented in terms of this variable x equal to minus j and y is equal to e to the power of minus h. You can convince yourself that, you know, for example, the fixed points are very, you can easily see there are there is one fixed point which is here, which for 0, 1. And then there is another fixed point here, which is 1, 1. Then there is a line of fixed point. Basically, what happens is the following. Physically, what we did before is this. That is, this is the zero temperature, a zero magnetic field line. That is, this y-axis is 1. H equal to 0 is 1. So it starts from any point, and then under renormalization, this will make the next j smaller and smaller. In fact, we had a graph last time how to solve that particular equation. We said that tan hyperbolic has this form, and tan hyperbolic square has this form. So you give me an initial value. It will tell me what is the next value of j, which is here. Then from here, from there I can go. And so my entire recursion amounts to reaching this origin, which is a fixed point for this discrete recursion relation, in infinite step. So in this x and the y para value, what we reached here saying that you start at any finite temperature. Then at finite temperature, we know that things are correlated over length scale called correlation length. And that you do the renormalization operation. By the time your scale goes up to the correlation length scale, beyond that, the new collective variables are essentially free. So you reach what is called infinite temperature fixed point. And they do it anywhere here. For example, suppose you start from here, then basically you reach this fixed point. The sense is like this. So you flow, start from anywhere. So this is like a reservoir of infinite fixed point. And so this fixed point is very clear, is repulsive. That is, you may look like you may have a system which looks very ordered over some length scale, which is a correlation length, but then it tells you that when you go beyond that length scale, it will be disordered, so you'll be driven to infinity. Similarly, you may apply a small magnetic field, which may tend to order, but essentially fluctuations get uncorrelated and you are driven here. So there is a fixed point here, which is a stable fixed point, which is related to symmetry breaking, because at this point, when I settle down at zero temperature, I don't know which direction I will point out. All spins may be pointing up or all spins may be pointing down. But the magnetic field gives a preference to one of the direction and then pulls everything towards that along this line. So the physics of what is going on in the one-dimensional Ising model is much more transparent in this particular analysis. than in the exact solution that we already know, that free energy is log of cos j. And also it's going to teach us what could happen in a higher dimension. Okay. Now let me do the two dimension. Professor Suni, I'm still learning my board operation. Long way to go. Okay. So now let me recall how I formally defined this operation. So this is what we want to evaluate. This is our eventual aim. But instead of dealing with these microscopic variables or trace over S, what you do is I put some function. I don't know what symbol I used, P. Such that that trace over so it's like resolving identity, that I just take unity here and then rewrite it in a language. So what this term does is, so for I'm explicit, so then so by definition this is unity, but now I interchange the order of my tracing. So this is going to give me a new effective Hamiltonian, which is JH, which contains, let's say, J prime and many other parameters. So this is the idea. Now, what is the explicit form of this P? The explicit form of P, I said for several cases. In one case, what I do is I am going to ask the question that I take a cluster like this. I have 5 spin cluster. I know that as I reach the critical point, these 5 spins will act together collectively. So I define a new variable, which is like a delta function, which says the new variable at this cluster, let me call the cluster as B, when it is equal to sine of, let me call this as 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. Now this is my definition of this P. P of sigma S for a given cluster. So I will do it for every cluster. Now by definition, since it's a Kronecker delta function, when I sum over this sigma, I get unity. Okay. Or I could choose, as I pointed out last time, because this choice of P has no parameter. Just is a sign. But it turns out when you do real operations, you take advantage of what's going to happen. You take advantage of the fact that you could have this condition, that is trace of P sigma equal to 1, by introducing several parameters here. For example, I could write this as exponential of minus sigma times a function of all the S's, and then put in the denominator cos so by definition, if I now integrate over the sigma, I will get cos again. So that will cancel with this, so it will be 1. But however, now instead of having this very simple, this is called majority rule. It says that if majority of the spins are up, I will call my collective variable up. But that may not be always the best strategy. I may have to give some softening of that, so which I may do by putting this appropriate F. And also I pointed out last time, when you do this here, you find that you generate, in addition to nearest neighbor, next nearest neighbor, and 4 spin coupling. So you want to subtract some of them, then you can choose a form of F. So here is hiding a very nice variational principle, which Kadanoff explains in one of his talks, one of his lectures. I will give the reference, where you can choose some, put some variational parameters here, and then fine-tune you with respect to the variational parameter and get the best result. So this is like during variational physics in quantum mechanics. So you introduce some variational parameter in the renormalization algorithm itself. And apparently, that's what happens in the deep learning that I pointed out before. So the system renormalizes and also optimizes some parameter. OK. Now I showed explicitly, for example, if you take this example, J, you have a central spin S5, S1 plus S2 plus. So you can choose some delta which corresponds to this. Then you integrate over S5, sorry, S1, S2. Then it gives you, I pointed out, that an effective Hamiltonian, which contains many terms. For example, after you integrate over, you, what you get is you get a originally you had S1, S5, and S1, nearest neighbor. Now you generate a new term which connects S5, and then what you get is it generates a coupling between S1 and S2. And then also it starts giving you a term like S1, S2, S3, S4. So we'll call it a four-spin coupling. Then the practical renormalization becomes hard, because next time when you do it, you'll have many, many cars, and you generate even six-spin couplings and so on. So in order to, so what you find here is, I'll write down the explicit solution, and then I will think about it. What happens is J prime, as before, becomes log of, as if, by the way, I had this relation between coupling constant at one level and another level in terms of tan hyperbolic J. It turns out you can rewrite it. It's like an algebraic thing. You can, in this language also. So the nearest neighbor coupling in the new lattice, which in this case is rotated because I'm integrating spins at every sublattice, then it has a new period which is square root of 2 compared to the previous one. And then it generates a new coupling between the new nearest neighbor spins. And then it also gives this coupling, that is, coupling between next nearest neighbor spin, which is 1 over 8th of log of cosh 4k. And then it also generates a four-spin coupling, which is, I will not, this simple algebra. So you see the proliferation of coupling constant. You started with the J, so you started in this parameter space. Some point here, very quickly you move here. So in order to describe the new next parameter, you need a three-dimensional. If you keep doing it from 3, you will go to 6 and so on. You will keep proliferating. So right at the beginning, you do a controlled approximation. OK, this is where, you know, some people call it as an uncontrolled approximation. But it's controlled in terms of physics. But mathematically, it's uncontrolled. But you check the validity of whatever you did by looking at the final result. So as a physicist, what I will do is, OK, so I started with nearest neighbor coupling. Then I generated in my new lattice. So I started with nearest neighbor coupling. That got renormalized to a value j. And then I generated this coupling. And then also I generated a coupling containing four spins. OK. So yes, what?
What is k in that?
It's j.
So my language is slightly different. Yeah, please, yeah, thanks for pointing out. Yes.
There was my question.
Okay. J and K fortunately are neighboring alphabets. Okay. Let's see. Yeah. So now I will think like a physicist because I'm trying to get some practical number for TC. I don't want to solve it like Ansager did. I want to get some value of TC. And also I want to get some estimate of these critical exponents. So what I will do is, okay. See, after all, this tells you that four spins want to be together. So good, that means it's you are approaching critical point. It is supporting that. So let me ignore this. So I just, without any rational, I just drop it by hand. Then I say that, okay, this spin, the newly generated, says that there is a new coupling between the two spins. And also it says there is a coupling between these two. So without thinking further, I say that I will take this coupling and put it here. Because from a distance, they all look like neighbors. This is a very crude, in fact, bond moving approximation. We will come back and rationalize this. Then in this language, what happens is, essentially, you project. That is, you started with some value of the parameter. You moved out. You say that, OK, I will project myself to this. I will keep living in the old parameter space. As a first approximation, it's good. OK, you do that. And then the next thing that you do is, you also expect that the critical point, for example, when you looked at the one-dimensional Ising model, we found that the critical point is j equal to 0. So in the two-dimensional Ising model also, you expect that the critical point will be close to 0. So what you do is you take this complicated nonlinear recursion relation and then keep the leading nonlinear term and see what happens. So I'm making one is I'm dropping this, and then I'm identifying next nearest neighbor coupling with nearest neighbor and lumping them together. And then I go to the nonlinear recursion relation that I get and make further approximation in this nonlinear function. This is what we could do at the beginning. In fact, that's what people did at the beginning. And then slowly improved and got this. Now they get very good result. So when you do that, this is what I get. K So I have done one more thing which I did not specify. Let me specify it. So having learned that if I start with nearest neighbor, I will generate next nearest neighbor four spin coupling. Having learned that, what I will do is I will start with the Hamiltonian, which contains, to begin with, next nearest neighbor coupling. And then do the operation. Then I will generate nearest and next nearest neighbor coupling and four spin coupling. And I will ignore the four spin coupling. So here, what I have done is, to begin with, I started with two values, k and k1. So I made my parameter space slightly larger, two-dimensional. And then did the operation. And within all this approximation, I land up again with two parameters. So k goes to k prime, and k1 goes to k1 prime. So the new value of k1 prime depends on what I started with. And then the new value of k prime is something that I started with, k next nearest neighbor coupling, and something that is generated. So this is simple algebra. I will not go into the details of the algebra. But what I have got is a nonlinear recursion relation. You can easily see it's a nonlinear relation. So it connects k1 and k to k prime and k1 prime in this. And it turns out this simple looking equation can give you a 30% accurate transition temperature and also critical exponent, an important critical exponent, which is related to specific heat as well as correlation divergence within 20% accurate. So you can imagine improving it. Yeah.
There we have essentially J prime, right? J prime.
Thank you. So K should be replaced by J. I'm very sorry.
But how can we prime equals J1.
Sorry? Yeah, yeah. What is the question?
I mean, like, how can we tell that J prime is determined by J1 and J1? Sometimes it's only determined by J1.
Ah, so that is simple. That is, now what I do is, when I do this operation, I have a J1 which contains cross coupling. J1.
So each time when we do it, we'll get the J4. Then we project that.
Exactly. I throw away J4.
But then
when I move to the third step, I will generate some other coupling cells. I keep ignoring it.
Okay. But like if we do this, suppose we don't ignore this, then J4 will produce J8, right?
Exactly.
But whether J4 will affect J2 prime and J1?
We'll have to do it in detail. What happens is when two four-spin couplings have a common bond,
yeah,
it will generate a four-spin.
Yeah.
And when the three of them overlap, they could in general generate two-spin of further neighbors.
Uh-oh.
So yeah, that's where you keep at the back of the mind the symmetry in the problem. We are dealing the problem in the absence of magnetic field. So whatever we generate better be invariant under all S is going to minus S. So in the most general way, you will generate even 8-spin coupling. You conspire to join with 6-spin coupling and generate a 2-spin coupling. So it will be a mess. So we are avoiding it right at the beginning and saying that for an approximate analysis, this is what we do. OK. Now this equation can be solved. So this has a fixed point. Solve this. That is, so what is a fixed point? So the right hand side should become the left hand side. So at the fixed point, J star is equal to J1 star plus 2J star. So you solve this and you get two values for this, which is 1/3 and 1/9. So that's the value of the fixed point. So that means in the parameter space of J1 and J2, I have J and J1, I have some number which is somewhere here. Okay. Now we are going to see that something interesting will happen. That is, we analyze the flow in the neighborhood of the fixed point. So here I should have given a general discussion about this, but I forgot. But let me give you, this is because you will see this in all the RG texts, so I will do this. It's fairly straightforward, but it's good to see this. I said that the coupling constant, set of coupling constant, which is a vector, is related to so let's think about J as some column vector in our mind. So give me a column vector, some point, I will go to the next point. So let me also assume that the this is a fixed point equation, which I can formally solve as I did for this case. Then what you can do is you can now what I want to do is I want to linearize the flow in the neighborhood of the fixed point. It's a nonlinear equation. Give me some point, I will give you another point. But in the neighborhood of the fixed point, things are going to flow linearly. And that's going to give me information about the exponents that I am seeking. So this is a straightforward thing. So what you basically find is that J n plus 1 minus J star is equal to a matrix W That is, this W has two indices because I have a column vector J, and then the column vector will be rotated by coming from the first derivative term and help. So this is the simple equation for this W is evaluated at the so what I have is a matrix equation. So I'll have to put an index alpha, then alpha beta and beta sum. Okay. Now this immediately tells me that in general, if I write it like this, for example, when I expand it, this one, different components of this J and J1 will get coupled. So what I can do is I can do a simple rotation by diagonalizing this matrix. Then it's like, you know, there are two eigendirections in which the flow is straight. If I'm somewhere else, the other one will pull me and then I'll have some trajectory. So making life simpler, I am diagonalized this Hamiltonian. And that will immediately tell me. So that means now I look at first the eigenvalue equation of this operator. If I take this and then substitute, it will tell me that there are new directions, new variables, which are linear combinations of these old ones, which has a very simple scaling behavior. That is, it goes as lambda. So there is no matrix here. Previously, if I started with J1 and J2, they will get mixed up here. I have just rotated it and have gotten the principal directions. So V1 will become the next one for all the n's, for all the alphas here. OK? It's something very simple. Any questions here? OK. Then I'm going to say that this lambda, the eigenvalue I get, is related to the scale that I do, because which is hidden in the recursion relation, times some exponent, which is characteristic of that particular eigenvector or particular direction. Now I will explicitly demonstrate it for our very simple case. OK, for our very simple case, if you do that is J minus J star, which we'll call as delta, and then J1 minus J1 star, you get a very simple equation just by expanding about the fixed point, delta K, delta J, 4J star. And then substituting for the values, what you find is 2, the matrix is 4 by 3, 1. So this is our W alpha beta matrix. So it turns out you start with nearest neighbor, then you and next nearest neighbor. As you flow, they mutually contribute to each other. So you have, in general, an off-diagonal matrix. So you'll have to rotate it appropriately. But we also saw that in the picture. That fixed point is close to J1 equal to 0. That is, the amount of next nearest neighbor generated is very small. And also, now we will see something very interesting, that the second eigenvector, as you approach a critical point, will be renormalized to 0 value. So that becomes what is called an irrelevant variable. So now you can, from here, diagonalize the problem, just 2 by 2 matrix, and then get the two exponent, and what you find is eigenvalue lambda 1 goes as b to the power of x, x, and then lambda 1 goes as b to the power of x1. And then in this case, x is equal to 1.57, and x2 is equal to minus 2.74. Sorry, x and x1. Saying that as you scale, this b is greater than 1, right? Because from a lattice parameter a, in this operation, I went to square root of 2, and so on. That is, yeah, please recall how I got it. So this is what I eliminated. That is, I eliminated sublattice A, spins in sublattice A. So I'm ending with a new lattice, which is this. So the new lattice parameter is square root of 2 times 2. So from 1 by 1, it's called, in fact, in crystallography literature, this thing will be called square root of 2 by square root of reconstruction and so on. Then you keep doing it. So this beta is something greater than 1. Now, since x1 is negative, that means under renormalization, very quickly this vanishes. So it justifies the assumption that we started with, namely, the next nearest neighbor interaction that we generated, we assumed it is small and it could be clubbed with J1, and that seems to be reasonable. You can do similar thing with four-spin interaction also. Then the analysis will be a little more, algebra will be complicated. Again, you will find that the corresponding eigenvalue is also negative. In other words, what is happening is you are starting from some point, and eventually you go float to a fixed point at the critical surface where the dominant number is J1. That is the nearest neighbor coupling constant. Others are very small, or there is some inverse relation among them, so we will not bother about it. OK, this is the thing. Now we can calculate from here. Already we had this value of J star. Where did I? J, yeah. I had the value of the exponent, 1/3 and 9/3. From that, you can find out that the TC compared to Onsager's value is about 30% off, which is not bad. To be, you know, for this, because we have, you know, we are trying to understand the structure of the problem as it at different scales. So we have been very crude. People, you know, in various lectures call it bad approximation, worse approximations, and so on. But take it in the right spirit. So in your exam papers, if you make this kind of approximations, I will tolerate, as long as it is physics guided. OK. So this problem has taught us that within these two parameters, there is one relevant direction and there is one irrelevant direction. And this relevant direction is what is taking us to the critical point. For example, if you apply a magnetic field, which will complicate this algebra, you can see similarly, the magnetic field becomes in a very relevant direction. And if you have a small magnetic field, you move away from this critical point. That means you move farther away from the critical surface and flow to infinity, as it happened in the one-dimensionalizing model. Apply a very small magnetic field, you are flown somewhere else. And you move away from the critical point in terms of temperature at zero magnetic field. Again, you flow to infinite temperature, fixed point. So all these things very nicely happen in this particular model. So this is the solution of two-dimensional Ising model. As I said, you can improve it significantly by doing some hard algebra and also introducing variational parameters in the definition of this block spin variable. So I took a very simple-minded block spin construction. You can go to a little more sophisticated block spins containing these Fs. For example, these Fs could have four-spin coupling to begin with in such a way that it cancels what I generate. In fact, that's what Kadanoff does in his paper and finds very accurate critical exponents and so on. And then later, this method was generalized by many others. So let me give the reference of Kadanoff, because I think it's a very important paper. Leo Kadanoff, PRL, Physical Review Letters, 16, volume 16 and page 's a very terse paper, but it's worth looking at it. Okay, so I think I have given you some feeling for real space renormalization group theory, and there are, you know, very picturesque process, something called Migdal's bond moving approximation. So having done all this, some people call it as a crime. Let me show how to do another thing which Migdal did and Kadanoff. So suppose I start with this model. Now I want to do renormalization. As before, since the coupling constants are, you know, cooperating and trying to construct collective local spins, what Migdal did was the following. Okay, he said that I'll remove this bond and put it here. So I, to begin with, I had J, J. So by hand, I will remove this and make it 2J. Having done that, I'll remove this and make it 2J. And having done that, I will do it. So just start from the original problem and then move bonds around such that at the end of the day, you have a new lattice in which there are spins. And then this spin is hanging free, so integrate it out. Nothing will happen. But now very something interesting happened. Now if you want to do renormalization, you can integrate over this spin exactly as we did before. Then it will generate a new coupling between these two. So by this procedure, I am in a systematic way projecting myself to the nearest neighbor subspace by fiat, by moving the bonds around. And it turns out this approximation works better than what we did before. Then there are systematic ways of moving. And in fact, the advantage of this is, Vikram Soni may remember, you can do this for lattice gauge theory. It turns out, if you want to understand some even non-abelian gauge theories, normally we deal it in a continuum. We write down vector potential and so on. But there is something called a lattice regularization of gauge theories in which you define link variables. And those problems become like Ising model problems, but with more complicated matrix variables. You can do this kind of approximations there, real space, bond moving, and so on, and get excellent results, excellent insight into even non-abelian gauge theory, get some information about the glue ball mass and so on. So this goes beyond simple Ising model. It goes to lattice gauge theories. And there is a whole game that you can play with. So let me stop here and now finish what I started some time ago, the solution of two-dimensional Ising model using transfer matrix method. If you have any questions, I'll be happy to answer. These are because we won't, of course, David will tell you how to do this systematically in momentum space. See, because what Kadanoff did was to try to give a physical picture in terms of block spins. But we know that these blocks lose their meaning. When you deal with, you know, scattering phenomena and when you look at fluctuations, Fourier modes are much more important or much more relevant. So what Kadanoff did was, what Wilson and company did was, look at Landau's free energy functional, which we already wrote down. And then that looks like a Fi-4 field theory. So now go to momentum representation. Then the theory tells you a probability distribution function for various momentum components and how they interact. And then traditionally, such interaction among momentum variables are treated using diagrammatic methods. So traditionally, what people do is they do resummation and take care of infinities through the old renormalization procedure. But after Wilson's insight, people like Fisher and others said that you can do the resummation that you do in standard perturbation theory in a much more meaningful and physical way by thinking of this kind of renormalization operation. That's what led to beautiful development called 4 minus D or epsilon expansion. It turns out when you do this, dimension d equal to 4, I had no time to focus on that, becomes something very special. There, mean field theory starts working well. So you can move around this in powers of 4 minus d, where d is treated as a mathematical continuous variable, and the three-dimensional correspond to d equal to 3 and epsilon equal to 1. So you can have a systematic expansion called epsilon expansion. Similarly, you can have a systematic expansion in terms of number of components. So physically, we may be interested in n equal to 2 or 3. So they have some radius of convergence, but these things give you a lot of insights about the universality and the dependence of critical exponents. So in order to do that, you escape from real space, you go to momentum space. Then in momentum space, you have, you know, you have some ultraviolet cutoff, which corresponds to some q maximum value, which is some cutoff inverse of 1. And then like I went to longer and longer length scale, now I would go to longer and longer length scale by integrating over momentum space. And then you get beautiful physics. OK. So that's the end of this discussion. Now let me very quickly go back to what I left before.
So maybe naive question. So if I knew the partitional function exactly, of course it must contain all the information about all the critical exponents and stuff like that, right?
Yes.
So why is it difficult to extract that information from there? So once I have one larger solution, is it difficult to extract this information?
Yeah. In fact, Onsager's solution gives you the most important thermal exponent, y. I was pointing out the thermal direction, you have an exponent. Onsager's solution gives you, that's it. It is contained there. But it does not contain the renormalization flow.
But it should be a solution for any coupling, right?
But only one coupling. So Onsager's solution is for nearest neighbor interaction. Suppose you add next nearest neighbor interaction. Onsager has no solution. Similarly, you add a magnetic field. Onsager has no solution. So like 1D Ising model, we have a solution, simple solution for nearest neighbor and magnetic field. Suppose I put long range interaction. Then I have a solution, but it becomes more and more complicated. Whereas in the case of 2D Ising model, I don't have exact solution. Once I move away from Onsager point, which is non-zero nearest neighbor coupling alone. You cannot accommodate magnetic field. You cannot accommodate next nearest neighbor coupling. Then the problem becomes hard. But what we extract at the end of the RG operation, the critical exponent, is contained in Onsager solution. But only one of the critical, it doesn't contain information about how the system moves away from criticality as I apply magnetic field. In fact, I just wanted to, before I close, very remarkable connection between the problem which Onsager did not solve. Onsager did not solve the problem of Ising model in the presence of a magnetic field. It turns out Zhomolodchikov, while studying conformal field theory, has come up with a conjecture that Onsager problem of Ising model in two-dimensional spin system in the presence of magnetic field is related to something called E8 symmetry. Apparently, in group theory, there are exceptional groups, even way up to E8. And this E8 group comes in a very beautiful way, according to Zhomolodchikov. And there are lots of proof, convincing argument for that Zhomolodchikov was conducted, including experimental support, saying that in this Ising model problem, E8 symmetry is hiding. I don't understand this. I would like to, this made some news a few years ago, because there were some experiments which corresponded to studying this Ising model in a magnetic field, and some of these predictions of Zhomolodchikov was confirmed there. Because I wanted to mention, because string theory friends love it. Heterotetic string theory is supposed to be related to E8 times E8. So there are very deep connections to some of the very sophisticated things, even at the level of two-dimensional Ising model. OK. So I left somewhere by setting a transfer matrix for two-dimensionalizing model. In one-dimensionalizing model, the transfer matrix that we have to study is very simple, which we already know. So here, whatever I did amounts to saying that focus on this. That is this. So I take a chain, which is moving along this direction, and take a spins that are interacting this direction, and then focus on the spins that interact from one chain to another chain. So I also said that you can write it as, you know, that is, you take this and take this interaction and call it as P, which is e to the power of minus j S I K summation over all k. This k stands for summation over the y index. Then it is the same column, so there is I here, and then there is this coupling between this pin and at the same level. So there is a Si k Si plus 1 k. So this is just a, you know, so the number of values that each S can take is, for example, all the S's here is 2 to the power of m, where m is the number of atoms in this chain. I can put periodic boundary condition for convenience later. So formally, you call it as a matrix, but which is huge, 2 to the power of n dimensional, m dimensional, where m is going to be as large as my system, as length of the system. And in one dimension, it was very simple because I had only one, I had a chain like this. I had only one side or two sides. My transfer matrix was two-dimensional, and I could play with it. So I pointed out last time that if you take this and think about it as a direct product of whatever is activity happening between these two spins and two spins. So it's as if you have direct product of some Pauli matrices here, 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 and so on. So that motivated me, and then I got the result that I have tau I k tau. And no, OK, one more thing that I did was, since when I finally do the problem, it is trace of p to the power of n. That is, I'll have to take a single transfer matrix and take it to the power of m, where m is also the number of sites as I move around, and take the trace. So I focus on one p. So I remove this index I and I plus 1 and call it as S prime. So this variable S tells me that they are coming from here, and S prime comes from the neighboring side. So without loss of generality, I did that. Then what I said was that, for example, in the case of one-dimensionalizing model, when you consider a transfer matrix, you had a term e to the power of 2j, which is the transfer matrix. So now what I did was, I rewrote this transfer matrix as and then rewrote it as e to the power of. In other words, if I think about it as a two-dimensional matrix, I can write it in terms of Pauli spin matrix. So it has that is, I take the diagonal part and call it as identity matrix times e to the power of j, then the off-diagonal part and call it as a tau x and e to the power of minus j. And then I can exponentiate it again. And then this theta is going to be a function of j. I wrote a form for theta. Let me see if I have it. Should have. It involves some log, yeah. So this theta is defined by tan hyperbolic theta is equal to e to the power of minus 2j. So simple algebra. So yeah, I have an off-diagonal transfer matrix. I write it in terms of poly spin operators. Sigma x appears here, and then j. So now when I do the same thing for our problem, so this is diagonal, and this is off-diagonal, because this is, when I write it a matrix form, that's what will give me this. Whereas here I'm working in the same chain, so I will not have off-diagonal term. So that gives me a transfer matrix, the operator P, which is e to the power of minus j in terms of this new variable tau k, k plus 1, times z, and e to the power of minus theta . So this was my transfer matrix. So this k runs from 1 to m, where m is the number of steps. So Ansager's achievement was to find out the largest eigenvalue of this matrix. As I said later, Leib, Schulz, and Matisse simplified the solution of Ansager by doing Jordan-Wigner transformation trick. So the problem amounts to now finding. So as I said, at some level, without justifying, I said that I can combine the two in the exponential. I have no time to justify that, but I just indicate this is also a function of j. So I want to find out the largest eigenvalue of this operator. That means I want to find out the lowest eigenvalue of this Hamiltonian. Because this, you can imagine it to be a Hamiltonian operator, exponential of minus some times it, for example, e to the power of, it looks like our familiar time evolution operator. Now there is no I here, so it looks like our thermal density matrix of some Hamiltonian. So what all I have to do is find out the largest eigenvalue of this particular operator. And this operator was studied by people like Leib, Schulz, and Matisse. This is called quantumizing model. Here, of course, I have a parameter j, then another parameter theta, which also depends on j and then t. So you can forget about temperature as a you can just imagine to be this to be an operator with some two parameters given j and theta at a given temperature and coupling constant. So solve this problem. So the solution of this problem is the central thing in Leib, Schulz, Matisse approach. So now you may be tempted to think of, so this problem is bilinear in terms of operator. There are only two operators and only, so why not diagonalize it by going to momentum space? You can do it. For example, you can define a tau of q, where q is a momentum variable, by defining for any of the Pauli spin operator components, e to the power of I k or I times tau of, let's see, L, where L is the site index. You can do this. Then what happens is, this tau, these variables, you can find out, they are no more independent, in the sense they have very complicated commutation relation among themselves for various q's. So you don't solve the problem. For example, if these taus were classical variables, like then you will say that they are quadratic, and you can diagonalize them going to momentum space representation. Here you cannot do that. There is a constraint coming from the fact that this tau's anti-commute, or tau's of this famous commutation relation, this is why you will have to go to some other basis which makes it friendly and which decomposes it in or independent in momentum space. This is what was achieved by Leib, Schulz, and Matisse. Let me indicate that. David, can you advise me? I can write down the solution, or do you, shall I go through it tomorrow? Which is some suggestion from the students. Would you like to see the derivation in some detail? Okay. Then I can do it tomorrow, because I don't want to go beyond 5 minutes. I won't be able to complete. It's very beautiful and very elegant. As this will be, the diagonalizing this Hamiltonian will take you to a Majorana-Fermion representation of this problem. You will see like a Dirac fermion, a Majorana-Fermion coming out. And that is what tells you. Also, another very important thing, since many of you learn field theory and conformal field theory and so on, whatever Kadanoff talked about, whatever we have been talking about, is just scale invariance. That is, I look at a critical state and change the length scale, then physics is the same. But it turned out something remarkable happened even in Ising model, which Ansager did not realize, that in addition to simple scale invariance, there is conformal invariance. That is, you can do deformation of this underlying space such that the angles between the curves are preserved. And then the thing is invariant. And this is something that was not proved until conformal field theory came. And for example, here it will become transparent once we find out that this transfer matrix operator is a free Majorana-Fermion at the critical point. Then one can borrow all those results from conformal field theory and say that Ising model in two dimension at the critical point is not only scale invariant, it's also conformal invariant. It's a very important result that came from Polyakov and others. Maybe tomorrow I will explain what is conformal invariance in simple language. Because in 1 plus 1 dimension, we are all familiar with that through complex variables. That is, in complex variable, you have conformal transformations using holomorphic functions. So that transformations that preserves angles. So remarkably, identical thing happens at the critical point in Ising model. And it was not at all obvious. Now suppose I go to three-dimensional Ising model, which is also critical, or I go to liquid gas critical point. There are conjectures saying that there also you have conformal invariance, but there is no proof. So this solution due to Leib, Schulz, and Matisse tells us more than a very simple critical phenomenon. So I think I will do it in some detail tomorrow before I wind up with some discussion about Boltzmann equations and kinetics. Thank you.